Okay, this is my first Tanoppi presentation, so if it fails, that's it. What I'm going to talk about is cluster sizes and temperatures, and this is our two images of how clusters look in the X-rays. Now, why am I here at the CMB? Okay. 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 So, why am I here at the CMB meeting talking about cluster and showing picture of clusters in the X-rays? Well, because for most of you that look at the intrinsic anisotropy of the CMB, cluster goes under the category of extragalactic foregrounds. So if you don't think about them as foregrounds, but you think about them as signal, you may learn something studying them through the SZ effect. So this is a working collaboration with Malcolm Yonkowski, Joe Moore, and Andrew Benson. So clusters are powerful probes of cosmology, like cosmological parameter like omega naught, omega matter, and sigma 8, and also of structure formation models, for example, the amount of primordial non-Gaussianity. And what I want to concentrate on is the size-temperature relation. Now, from observation, and here I show some of them, in a logarithmic scale, if you put here the X-ray temperature of the cluster and here the, in a logarithmic scale, the observed radius of the cluster, they follow a linear relation and with a tight scatter around this line, and the slope of this line goes like about T to the temperature to the 0.9. You don't see this part. So these are local clusters, so local universe Z equals zero, and these are intermediate redshift cluster, the medium redshift here is 0.3. Now, what we want to do, we want to understand why they follow this particular relation with this tight scatter and this slope, and possibly to find an explanation analytically. Okay, this is the radius of the cluster, the observed radius, and this is the temperature in the X-rays. Right, so,
What do you mean by radius?
In this case, it's the isophoton radius. But, you need to ask the observers what that is. Yeah. I mean, for the scatter, it doesn't really matter, just scale it. So, since we want to do things analytically, let's start from the top hat spherical collapse model. And from this, it is possible to relate to, let's say, observational quantities, even though they are not directly observable, like the virial temperature and the virial radius of a cluster, to some more theoretical quantities, like the formation redshift of the cluster and the virial mass of the cluster. And we use the formula in Kitayama Sutton 96. I don't write the formula here because they are complicated, but I explain the effect in this graph. This is, again, the X-ray temperature in a logarithmic axis, and this is the radius in a logarithmic axis. Now, this radius is not exactly the virial radius. It's closer to the core radius, so it has been rescaled in a sensible way, meaning such a way that a cluster of a mass of 10 to the 15 solar masses has got this radius of about 0.16 megaparsec h to the minus 1, which makes sense. Now, let's take one mass, a fixed mass, and observe this cluster today, but make it collapse, for example, today, a redshift 0.3 or a redshift 1, and here is where it would lie on this plot. And then as you increase the mass, you move in that direction. As you increase the redshift of collapse, you will move in this direction. So in structure formation model, where most of the cluster collapsed recently, you would expect sort of a tight relation along this line. Okay? And to increase or decrease the scatter, you can try to play with omega naught, sigma 8, or the amount of primordial non-Gaussianity. I have to add here that for creating this plot, I'm assuming a lambda CDM model with Hubble constant, small h, 0.65. But this doesn't really depend that much in the Hubble constant. Well, the Hubble constant, we know, is not 300 and it's not 30. So it doesn't really depend on the Hubble constant for sensible value of the Hubble constant. Now, what do I mean by primordial non-Gaussianity? Let's make an example now. Imagine this y is the delta, the fluctuation field, normalized in such a way that it's got variance of unity. Now, the continuous line is a Gaussian distribution. This is the probability. And the dotted line is a log-normal distribution. Now, clusters are rare objects, so we would expect them to be at the 3 sigma peaks or higher. So they should be on the right of this arrow. Now, we can consider the quantity that is the integral from here above in the non-Gaussian case divided by the integral from here above in the Gaussian case. And this is the quantity called G in Robinson et al. 2000. And this is one sort of non-Gaussianity you can consider. We consider this because it's not log-normal, so it's analytic, but, I mean, you can consider anything else if you want. Now, the ingredients. First ingredient is the distribution of halo masses, and here we use just the Price-Schechter because we know it works reasonably well. The agreement with simulation is not perfect, but at this level it's good enough. And written like this, it's generalized to a non-Gaussian case because P of mu, where mu is delta over sigma, for a Gaussian case is like this. For a non-Gaussian case, it's just substitute with the appropriate PDF. The next ingredient is the distribution of formation redshift. And to do this, we generalize the Sasaki 94 distribution to non-Gaussian initial, to PDF for non-Gaussian initial condition. And this is the same, is the first derivative with respect to mu of this probability. And notice here that this is the redshift of formation of the object, while this is the redshift of observation of the object, so of the cluster. And another ingredient is the observational weighting, because when you observe from cluster, they are, you usually have a flux-limited sample. So the probability of observing a cluster goes like luminosity in the X-rays to the power 1.5. Now, the luminosity scales like the temperature to the power 2.5 to 3, so the weight we effectively have in is like T to the power 3.75 or 4.5. Now, we do use 3.75, but the result wouldn't change that much if we use another weighting in this range. With this ingredient, we do some Monte Carlo realization of clusters in the size temperature plane and compare with data. So this is our result. What I show here in the top three panel is a lambda CDM model for cluster observed in the local universe, so depth of observation is zero. And here again is the temperature in the X-ray in a logarithmic axis. This is the radius in a logarithmic axis. So this is a lambda CDM with Gaussian initial condition cluster normalized, following the value from Vianen and Little 99. And as you can see, you can recover the scatter. Probably you slightly underpredict the scatter, but not that much. If you increase sigma 8, keeping all the rest fixed, you increase the scatter. And there is one thing to notice here, and it's easy to notice in this panel here, is that when you naively fit with a line those data, you would expect a slope. Steeper slope like this, right? While theoretically, if all clusters would collapse at redshift zero, the redshift you observe them, the slope will be this one, which is much shallower. Why is this? Because if we look down here, we are looking at low mass objects. A low mass cluster can collapse on a wider range of redshift. Of course, if you have a very massive cluster, it's likely to collapse today. If you have a small cluster, it's likely to have collapsed before. So that's why probably, or this is probably part of the explanation, this, the observed data, do not follow the same slope. This is what happens if you keep the same sigma 8, but then introduce some amount of non-Gaussianity. This amount of non-Gaussianity is quite big. You have 10 times more 3 sigma peak in the non-Gaussian case, 3 sigma or higher peak in the non-Gaussian case than in the Gaussian case. And as you can see, the scatter is huge. This is what happened for an Einstein de Sitter model. Now, what the value I've chosen here are the best fitting parameter for an Einstein de Sitter model found by Robinson et al. So omega 1, sigma 8.4, and this parameter of non-Gaussianity 10. As you can see, you would fit the cluster abundance, because they fit the cluster abundance, but the scatter you predict is far too big with respect to the observation. So now what you can do with these tools in your hands is explore better the space parameter omega, sigma 8, and g. So to do this, we use a two-dimensional Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. Now, these are not likelihoods. These are the confidence level of the 2D Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. So now, these thin lines are for the Einstein de Sitter case, and these thick lines are for the lambda CDM model. Now, you cannot see it, I don't know why, but... Okay, thanks. So here is G, here is sigma 8, here is sigma 8, and here is omega naught. So what this plot is telling us is that a model that lies here is much less likely than a model that lies here, or a model like here is much more likely than a model that lies here. Okay? So... you saw before that the Einstein de Sitter with sigma 8.4 and G 10 was somewhere out here and predicted a scatter far bigger than the one actually observed. Now, another constraint you can put in this plane is the one arising from just the observation of cluster abundance. And this is the line I would get just applying press Schechter and trying to fit the cluster abundance observed by Viana and Lidl 99. And so this is the central value, and these are the error bars. So let's see. If we consider sigma 8 of 0.99 and a lambda CDM, the most likely value that would cross as well with the cluster abundance will be a small non-Gaussianity, G equal 2. Or if you want the most likely value for this KS test will probably be with a higher sigma 8 or a slightly higher omega. It's just omega 0.3 and lambda 0.7. It's just flat. In this case, we find that in the sigma 8 omega plane, we can fit the constraint from the SP relation with this formula, so 0.8 omega to the minus 0.26, which is slightly different from the constraint you get from cluster abundance. So in principle, you can try to break this degeneracy using together scattering the SP relation and cluster abundance. A high redshift, you would expect the scatter to decrease, because if you look at high redshift, clusters have less time to collapse, have a small interval in redshift where they can collapse. And this is what happened. So this is a redshift 0.3 for a lambda CDM with the Gaussian initial condition. And what I overplot are observational data that have medium redshift of observation 0.3, but actually the redshift span from 0.19 to 0.54. That's why you have some point here that I have some point here that I cannot fit. And at z equal 1, the scatter decreases. So in principle, if you could observe few clusters at redshift equal 1 and put them in this plot, you could constrain cosmological parameter much more easily, because the scatter just goes down.
Yeah. What
direction would a lightning systematic effect moving from the left, potentially how much? What are the biggest
concerns? This you have to ask to a server. And just. I mean, you can get, I don't know, you can get the radius wrong, or you can get the temperature wrong, but... But, I mean, in the first plot, there are the error bars of the data, and I can show them to you, if I can go back. Where? Okay, so you see, those are the errors you may expect. And I think this can answer your question, right?
Yeah, I was asking how there's a systematic error in all of them.
So let me draw some conclusions. We presented an analytical model that predicts the size temperature distribution of clusters and seems to predict properly the scatter. And this seems to be in agreement, at least by eye, with the data. And also it has got the right redshift of the dependence on the redshift on which you observe the clusters. It has got a very sensitive dependence on cosmological parameter omega naught and sigma 8 and the amount of primordial non-Gaussianity. So you can, in principle, constrain those parameters using the ST relation. And this constraint seems to be complementary to cluster abundant constraints. So in this way, one can break the degeneracy between these three parameters. A nice sitter with sigma 8.4 and non-Gaussianity G10 is ruled out because predict a scatter that is too big. And a lambda CDM model cluster normalized will need a small amount of non-Gaussianity or slightly higher G or sigma 8 or omega. Then we hint the suggestion that the observed slope is steeper because low mass objects form over a wider range of redshift. And in principle, even though we've used X-ray data, one could use the data from SZ cluster catalogs. I have to choose. Lady first.
So I have a question about using low mass objects. One thing you could argue is that other physical practices that limiting the subject model, like the
Well, there may be other ingredients that were not put in because we wanted to do everything analytically and just use the press factor that we know doesn't have a perfect agreement with what you think the mass function actually is. But this qualitatively tells you that you can sort of sift through the model much more rapidly because you can do this calculation in a very easy way and then go to the next step and put in more complicated physics. Do I answer your question? Well, the agreement is not perfect. Well, then we check that for a known mass, like, say, 10 to the 15 solar masses, redshift in local universe, you get something sensible, something that is in agreement with observations. So, in principle, yes. The two things are consistent. You were in the queue before. Yes, but well, it's. Well, it's also that for high mass objects, you would expect the spherical collapse model to work better than for low mass objects. So for cluster, you would expect it to work better than for galaxies. I think that would, as Mark said, increase the scatter probably rather than decrease the scatter.
Se appende, lo attacchi qua con la molla qua. complicatissimo.
Okay, so again on clusters, I'm Elena Tirpali, I work at UBC, and I'll present the work that I've been doing with Douglas Scott, that I'm doing actually with Douglas Scott and Martin White. Again, why are we talking about cluster here? Well, the reason in specifically is that they can help. I mean, we have seen that large-scale structure can help in determining the parameter that now people are trying to determine with the CMB. So this morning's talk just shortened my introduction. So basically, you have seen from yesterday's plot and from today's talk of Dick that even if one adds the week prior that are completely reasonable, one already gets very much different results from the whole boomerang dataset, for example, alone. But if one adds some information about large-scale structure, then, for example, the omega lambda can be determined much better. So the main point is we shouldn't just concentrate on the CMB now that we have these very nice CMB results, but we should try to be careful about also about large-scale structure. So what I noticed about Dick's talk is that the fastest graph that passed by was the one about the priors on large-scale structure, and I wonder why. So the large-scale structure priors are basically given, as Dimitri said, through the shape of the power spectrum, gamma, and through the normalization that is parameterized by the mass variance on 8 megaparsec scale. So we are trying to look closer to this constraint that is put on sigma 8. This constraint has been put, as Licia has mentioned before, through the cluster abundance in the nearby universe. So this exercise has been done by several people. The idea is one has a formula, the Press-Schechter formula, that allows you to predict the number of objects over a certain mass range if you give the mass variance at the redshift of interest. And then, unfortunately, since it's very difficult to observe the masses of objects, it traduces this relation on the mass into a relation on the temperature and make use of the mass temperature relation that can be calculated, for example, through the spherical collapse, top hat spherical collapse. Then, typically, it is necessary to find some virialization rate out of this formula, and people have done it in different ways. One way is to differentiate this Press-Schechter. Other people has used this merging correction, which actually modulate the Press-Schechter. And so this is done in order to introduce the mass temperature relation that is given at the virialization redshift. Well, this exercise has been done by different people. Oh, well, of course, at the end, one gets the number of objects that are above a certain temperature. So clusters, typically this is done with clusters that have a X temperature of above, say, 6 keV or so. And in the end, people quote relation like sigma 8 equal omega m to some power. This has been done only for either open universes or flat universes, and the reason for that is simply that this was the framework in which we were moving a while ago, and nobody has carefully determined this relation in the case of a generic curvature or a generic mixing of omega n and omega lambda that would eventually include some of the some slightly closed models, I mean with a negative curvature. And this becomes essential if you want to do the parameter estimation, because we have seen that the universe is almost flat, but not quite. So we have to look at both sides of the curve, right? Okay, so we tried to, the idea was try to redo this exercise. And while we are doing so, we also try to look at each single ingredient and see whether it could be retreated, or if there were updates or some other way of facing the problem. Let me tell that, of course, the omega m and omega lambda entered this relation in several different points. Well, of course, it enters in the variance through because the variance can be expressed through the variance now times a growth factor that depends on the cosmology. It enters in this big delta C, and it also enters, I didn't write it completely here, but in this mass temperature relation. So, well, first of all, of course, we redid what everybody else have done in order to check that we had a basic code that was running fine and so on. And but then trying to look further, we noticed that quite recently has been published a few papers that come out from people that deal with simulation, and they has stressed the fact that Presser Schechter is quite right, but not completely right. There were two separate works. One is from Schett et al., 99, and with the GIF simulations, and the other one is from the Virgo Consortium collaboration, and Jensky et al., something. So I'm quoting here the Schett et al. Formula, and you see that it is similar to the what the Presser-Schechter would predict. This is just one part of the Presser-Schechter formula. That's the relevant part. But one needs to introduce some correction. This is one correction. In fact, is a minus 0.3, and then there is this A thing. So, using these formulas instead of the standard Presser-Schechter has the advantage that this corresponds more or less to the real world. It's not an analytical thing. It's something that comes out from simulation, so one doesn't need to do any merging correction or other kind of sort of weird consideration. So the other part that we try to work on is this mass temperature relation that heavily enter the calculation. And, well, there is a lot of literature on this subject, and I probably never finished to read it. I didn't finish to read it yet. What we found is that, well, I'll tell you later. Pardon? I couldn't hear it. Oh, I have to, okay. Correct. They took... Right. In fact, this is the main difference with the Presser-Schechter that they introduced. So, but it is compared to simulation. They claimed... Yeah. So let me go back exactly to this point, to the difference between the two formulas. So these are the two formulas, and they differ slightly, but anyway, what is relevant in the whole calculation is that when you actually do the calculation for clusters above 6.2 keV, you end up being always on one side of this point where the two where the two curves cross. And so if you use press ejector, you typically underestimate the cluster abundance. So doing what I'm plotting here is nothing but the, let's say, Viana and Lidl et al. I compare with Viana and Lidl and Wang et al. And these are the two curves for just an omega for a flat universe. If you introduce this simple correction, what you get is that your sigma 8, predicted sigma 8, is actually lower by about 10%. I'm sorry, that's omega naught. So, well, then we fitted this thing. We actually computed it for various omega m and omega lambda, and this is the fit. But you don't want to write it down because there will be soon a better one, right? So this is just to say that the machinery is implemented. Nothing. Wang et al. They had the aim of computing this sigma 8 constraint for quintessence model. So I just took it for the method. The only difference between the two is that the Wang et al. Used as a formation rate of objects, used a derivative of the press ejector, and they claim that they added on top of it some merger correction from the Sasaki and from the Lace and Cole 93 paper. They don't say how, but they say that it doesn't make very much difference. In fact, since I didn't know how to do it, I didn't introduce it, and this is the result without the Lace and Cole. And also they model the other difference is that they claim to have fitted the, not the integrated temperature function, but different bins from the Henri Arnaud data, which are the same that also Viana and Lidl use. And the other difference that I found is that the mass temperature, the relation that they use, has the same redshift dependence and everything, but a slightly different normalization, like 10% or something. So, but I mean, the two agree quite well, right? And the formula in the end, also the other thing is that the Wang et al., since they were doing quintessence model, they didn't want to fix gamma and take, you know, CDM style power spectra. And while I always did, like Viana and Lidl do, that they fix gamma to a certain value. They would actually really compute the sigma 8 with the power spectra from quintessence. But when you look at the limit in which the quintessence is equal to the cosmological constant, I don't see very much the difference. So, but they wanted, anyway, so let me go on. So the point here is that just with that, just introducing that new ingredient, the differences are quite relevant, okay? So the other part is the mass temperature relation that confuses me quite a bit. So there is this prediction that the mass should go as the temperature to the 3 over 2. And, this is well confirmed by simulations, but it has been stressed that this is true only for quite high temperature clusters, because apparently at low temperatures there is a steeper relation, suggesting that it is not actually the collapse that is leading the mass temperature relation, but maybe other mechanism. So then one goes to simulations to trying to normalize this thing, and what you find is that they all agree sort of, but with a 20% uncertainty, which is quite big. and they have also an intrinsic scatter of the same order of magnitude. Also, simulations quote the normalization only for the z equal to zero, so they, in some sense, they imply somehow that in this scatter there is already taken into account this redshift effect of formation of structure, so one shouldn't really integrate over redshift. The other thing is that simulation, unfortunately, are carried out only on for some specific cosmological models, typically either flat lambda model or for open models. And the quoted normalization differ by like 7 or 10%. So if one wants to do this, use this formula, it is hard if you want to. If we want to consider whichever combination of omega m and omega lambda. Then there are some papers, there is a paper that came out recently that stresses the fact that probably this is not even the correct way of determining the mass-temperature relation from the top hat collapse, because actually cluster continuously receive matter. They form because they receive continuously matter that accretes on the cluster, and so the temperature is not the one that is inferred simply by taking a cluster at a certain redshift and collapsing it. And so they say that the agreement between the simulation and the temperature and the mass-temperature theoretical relation is somehow accidental. But anyway, so there is this issue of trying to understand maybe what can simulation can tell us because of this big scatter implies then a big uncertainty on the sigma h omega m relation. And so we should try to see if we can have some better information from the simulation. So then there is the issue of the sample. With what do you compare? All the papers that came out compared their prediction with the Henri Arnaud, maybe revised catalog, which is composed of 25 clusters, only 20 of which has a temperature above 3.5 keV, for example. So we looked around what we could find, and apart from a very private Blanchard catalog of 50 clusters that for sure are beautiful but not public, we found this Markevich paper. Markevich selected 31 clusters in a local universe with a fairly high temperature, and he claims that it is practically a volume-limited sample, which also implies that maybe you don't have to care too much about the luminosity-temperature relation, which could also be an issue in if you had a flux-limited sample. So the other advantage about this catalog is that, well, Markevich claims to have corrected both the temperature and the luminosities of this cluster for cooling flows, but also other people has worked on the same clusters, and they found probably more reliable temperature for this cluster. So we think that this might be a good data set to construct the temperature function, actually. So, and maybe it would be better to fit the temperature function profile instead of the integrated one. And we'll probably try that way. So here are my conclusions. So it's a work in progress, as you have been seeing. So the main goal is try to find a formula for sigma 8 for whichever cosmology. And using the most updated and careful data one can have, and the new mass function that seems to play a big role in this game. Well, while we are doing so, we would like to assess which are the main sources of the error in our sigma A3 relation at the end, looking carefully at all the various detailed relation that could imply an error in it. Okay, that's it. It was fast. Well, no, it was first.
I'm wondering if sigma A is a large square variable. Like, what about sigma of? I know there's different ways to make that, but
well,
sigma of, you know, then something of a negative 10 is an 8 subscript of, like, you know, a better.
What?
I often thought, you know, it would be nice to have the strength in a nicer format. I thought it would be something that was limited.
Sigma. Well, yeah, Blanchard already suggested this thing. We might decide to do it. The thing is, in order to check with other people, then you have to do what they did first, and then, and this is what. So yeah, Blanchard. Well, I was using the full power spectrum, and for example, well, we didn't go. This is in the pile that I didn't read it. No, I saw that you published something on it, but I wouldn't be able to comment right now because I honestly didn't read the paper. I don't know if I have collaborators that can come and help me at that point, but I read about, I don't know, 20, I wanted to make just a plot of the list of papers that I read up to now for one graph that I showed, but
the other way from what you might expect, and argue about, and say, oh, about this way, my temperature scale is 50.
I read the paper. I promise. I'm sorry, confused. Void space. Yeah, 26th of June this year. I don't remember the astro pH number, but precise enough. Okay, is that it?